Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is an RNZ podcast.
The problem is that she was telling the truth in that she was abducted from her home and raped. It's an incredibly, you can't get much more traumatic than that for a child.
Hi, I'm Jesse Mulligan, host of the Daily Afternoons program on RNZ. You're listening to Crimes NZ, a series where I talk with people who are connected in some way or other with serious crimes that have happened here in New Zealand. In this episode, we cover the wrongful rape conviction of David Doherty and the fight to free him with Donna Chisholm, a journalist who led the campaign.
He was accused of abducting and raping his 11-year-old next-door neighbour. She was taken from her home, bound with shoelaces, taken to the nearby bowling club and attacked. And she named David as her assailant.
OK. And what was his situation at the time? Was he a known criminal?
Yes, he had a number of convictions for things like burglaries, car conversions, cheque frauds, but he had no record for violence or sexual offending. So he was kind of prolific but low level, and he was living at home with his partner Joanne and Joanne's children at the time, and he was employed.
Did he have an alibi at the time?
Well, Joanne gave evidence at the trial that he was with her, so yes.
Yeah. And the little girl, did she ever change her mind on that?
I think that the problem is that she was telling the truth in that she was abducted from her home and raped. It's an incredibly, you can't get much more traumatic than that for a child. It was in the middle of the night. There had been some bad blood between the neighbours in the month leading up to that. David and Joanne had moved in a month earlier. The complainant's brother had been bitten by David's dog. The complainant's family had the dog put down. There was an ongoing dispute, and a police reinvestigation suggested that there was this degree of animus might have informed why she named David, because he was the kind of bogeyman.
Yeah.
But she was telling the truth in every other respect.
Yeah. Interestingly, she described the person who'd attacked her as clean-shaven.
I think that's just one of those, yes. And that actually spoke a lot to her truthfulness, because she didn't resile from that. She could have said, she could have changed her testimony on that and say, well, look, I got it wrong. I remember now he had a moustache, which David did all his adult life. So, you know, she stuck to her guns on that.
Okay.
But it was just an error.
But nonetheless, the police decided they had their man?
Well, she was a pretty credible, compelling witness.
Yeah.
He was a next-door neighbour. He had a record for burglary, which sometimes can be linked.
Yeah.
In some ways, yes, they had their man, and then everything else fell into place for them. But no, they didn't go looking for any other possibilities. And of course, the fact that they didn't, 4 months after that, the person who actually did rape this child abducted two other children from their home in West Auckland, and then he was subsequently in prison for that. And of course, in the time that it took to identify him, he went on to rape several other women.
Oh, okay. Meanwhile, David Doherty is charged and goes to trial. What happened in that first trial?
Well, there was no DNA evidence, despite the fact that semen had been identified on the girl's underwear and pyjamas. DNA was in its infancy in 1993 when the trial was. I mean, the abduction was a year earlier, 92. So basically at trial, you had a very credible child saying it was David, and you had Joanne saying, no, he was with me. He was convicted.
jury or just a judge?
It was a jury.
Yeah, okay. So what happens? He goes to jail.
Yep.
And presumably not a very pleasant place to be for a convicted child rapist.
No, although he, when I talked to him over the years, he never said that he was attacked in any way. I think that probably other inmates believed him when he protested his innocence. So his father was very much aware of new developments in DNA technology, and he, as much as anyone, pushed for the stains on the girls' underwear to be retested using the new technology. And this happened in 1994, and there was an appeal hearing in November 94, which threw out his appeal because of the very equivocal interpretation of that DNA, I'm being polite here, by the ESR.
Can you explain that to me? What do you mean?
Well, they did their tests, and I've actually got the chart here, and it showed very clear evidence of somebody else's DNA in that semen stain on the underwear. Very unequivocal, there was somebody else. Mm. However, the scientist took it on herself to interpret signals that were below the control dot on that result as evidence that David could be there, because that was his signal. She said that could be his signal.
Right.
And there the whole scientific debate erupted as to whether those very faint signals, which were below the control dot, at which should be the cut-off point for interpreting them as representing anything, whether they represented something.
So she went looking for signs that could be used to support the earlier verdict and found some.
Well, this was very early days, and it was the independent scientists said that this was a cross-reaction in the test kit, and the control dot strength was designed to rule out things like that. However, she ruled it in, I think out of a desire to support the status quo.
Who was Ari Gerson?
Well, Ari happened to be at the Court of Appeal that day on a different case with Murray Gibson, the lawyer, and when he saw the report in the Herald about the case, it reported something along the lines that the DNA evidence pointed both away from Doherty and towards him. And as a molecular biologist, Ari knew that that was a nonsense, and he urged Murray to have a look at it.
Murray, David's lawyer.
Well, he wasn't David's lawyer then.
Okay.
But he had worked. Ari right. and Murray had worked together on the first DNA case in New Zealand, which was the case of Michael Pengelly, who was the first person convicted of murder on DNA evidence pretty much alone in New Zealand, and that was in 1990. So they had a relationship, a working relationship, and Ari exhorted Murray to actually go and have a look at this, which he did.
And is that about the time that you start getting interested?
Well, a friend of mine who was also a lawyer tipped me off that Murray had a great DNA case, and of course, to a journalist in those days, the DNA was catnip because it was new and it was exciting and it was involved serious crime. But it took me, I rang Murray and he essentially said, go away. And for many, many months, he told me to go away because what I didn't know, but what they were doing at that time was casting around the world to try to get other scientists to look at this test result. They were getting the files from the ESR, and they were going around the world to find independent experts who would offer an opinion. And in the end, they found two, one from California who actually had developed the very test kit that was used in this test, and another, Stephen Gutowski from Australia. The first one was Rebecca Reynolds. And together they gave reports to support what Ari's view was, that this wasn't David and they had the wrong guy.
Okay. So you were calling up to urge them to have another look at the DNA. Meanwhile, they were doing that in the background.
Well, no, I was urging them to talk to me about this case because I didn't know anything about it.
Okay.
But so when they finally got these reports, It might have been a bit before then, actually. It was about mid-95 that I finally got to see them and talk to Ari, and then I had to sit on it and sit on it and sit on it until Murray wanted me to wait until he actually petitioned the Governor-General to exercise the royal prerogative of mercy in David's case, because that was all that was basically left to him after the Court of Appeal had turned him down.
Yeah, can you explain that to us? Because I don't think that's come up in this segment before, but does that still exist, that if you exhaust your legal channels, you can go to the Governor-General and say, It's quite a power for the Governor-General in a role that doesn't have many proper powers.
No, well, they get a QC or a retired judge to look at the facts, or in fact their own lawyers at the Ministry of Justice, and they make a recommendation to the Governor General.
Okay.
So, and that didn't go in until March 1996, and that's when we first published in the Sunday Star Times.
And what's your relationship to Gibson and the scientists at this point? They're talking to you now. Taking your calls, not screaming you.
I think they've forgiven me for pestering them.
But at that point, when you go to the Governor-General, you're sort of part of the team, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely, because I'd been on board for months before that. I mean, you shouldn't get to be part of a team. And in fact, I thought that we'd do the story, everybody... And in the first story, I quoted the ESR as saying that he would be very concerned as a member of the jury if there was another person's semen on the rape complainant's underwear, and he congratulated those who were raising it. So I thought, this will all be over in 5 minutes. Everybody will say, we got it wrong, let's get this guy out of jail, and sorry, and on your way. Because Murray said, look, I'll give you this first go at it, but then I'm opening it up to all the other media to have a go. And then nobody wanted a bar of it. Nobody was really interested until we got him out.
Because let's release this child rapist isn't like immediately what people,
no.
the cause that people want to get behind.
No, and Michael Forbes, who was the editor of the Sunday Star Times at that point, the story didn't really sell. And he hammered it and hammered it and hammered it for, until the retrial was ordered, when we couldn't hammer it anymore. But it didn't sell. So he did it because it was the right thing to do.
Good for him. It was called the Goliath Fight for David. And did you get much reader feedback?
Well, it's a difficult... You got reader feedback in those days, not instantly. You know, they had to write a letter and post it.
Yeah. Even now with email, it's very hard to get any sort of reader feedback, isn't it?
No, I mean, there was... Yeah. And to a lot of people, it was an unpopular fight. And they sort of felt, well, if he didn't do this, he did something, so it doesn't really matter.
Right. So was that first conviction quashed then?
Yes, it was quashed by the Court of Appeal in August 1996.
It was a big deal, eh?
I mean, yes, but it wasn't quashed and on your way. It was quashed and a retrial ordered.
Okay.
On the basis that there were now three experts who were saying that this was wrong.
Mm-hmm. And then a Melbourne scientist called Stephen Gutowski does some further testing.
He was one of the first experts, but then he did further testing and got a better profile. Because in those days the technology was progressing apace, and it was becoming easier to get more detailed profiles. The one we had in the first instance was simply an exclusion profile. It didn't really go a long way to identifying who the real culprit is, but Gutowski got a much better result because Ari had the exhibits sent to him. But that was the first of many retests. I mean, the government wanted another test as well.
Okay.
Later on.
And even though, okay, so even though this DNA evidence appears to be exonerating David Doherty, the Crown decides to go to trial again.
Yes, indeed. A mystery to me.
Yeah. Okay, and what happens?
Well, they argued, and I'll never forget the line from the Crown prosecutor, that he said it wasn't hard to imagine how this was ejaculate wiped from a surface. That was how he described the stain in the girl's underwear of the other man's semen. It was somehow wiped from a surface. I mean, I think in these days of trace DNA, you might have more comprehensively of how trace amounts might get there, but this was fresh, hadn't been through the wash, It was in the crotch of her underwear. It was on her pyjamas. But they still went ahead. And actually, the jury was out for longer than at the first trial. The jury was out for something like 10 hours.
Were you there waiting?
Oh, gosh. Yes. Yes. Hideous. It was hideous.
And they came back and said what?
They came back and said not guilty. And the place kind of erupted as politely as you can in that situation.
Yeah. So what happens then?
In terms of the process?
Yeah, so he is not convicted at the retrial.
Right. So he goes home.
Presumably he'd already spent a bit of time in prison.
I think he was sent back to prison the night before the verdict. I don't know why that was, but he was. So he has to then go and start his life over as an acquitted man. But there was then, well, if it wasn't him, who is it? So the police reopened the investigation. They had an investigation into their investigation. But Doug Graham was not going to offer any compensation.
This is the Justice Minister at
the
time.
Yes, indeed. So Murray and Ari and I then worked on a request for an ex gratia payment for the 3.5 years that he'd spent inside. And this was the first approach since Arthur Allen Thomas's payout many years before that. And that led to a new series of rules being established for how people would be compensated.
What does ex gratia mean?
It means doesn't mean anything legally. It's just a nice thing to do,
okay.
An ex gratia thing to do.
Yeah. And by the way, Doug Graham had rejected his bid because he said that his innocence hadn't been proven.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was another slap in the face for David, who was trying to, you know, live a life.
We haven't talked much about his personality. What sort of guy was he?
I liked him a lot. He was... I remember when I went to see him in jail before we got him out, and, you know, when you approach people like this in these situations, you can either be impressed by somebody or you can think, well, this is going to be pushing it uphill because they're not a character that people are going to warm to. But he was very quietly spoken. He was articulate. He was well-read, polite, to the point of just, you know, excruciatingly courteous and kind.
Were he and Joanne still together?
Yes, they were together till he died.
Tough for her as well, eh?
Yeah, hugely.
I mean, she knew that he was innocent, basically.
Oh, absolutely she knew.
Yeah.
And she stuck by him to her credit.
Yeah. And it must have been frustrating for him going through this new battle for compensation, but it eventually happened.
It took too long to happen. Doug Graham said in 97 that he wasn't, you know, hadn't proven his innocence. 1998, Stuart Grieve, the QC, was appointed to see whether he had proven his innocence on the balance of probabilities, which was the test of whether he would be compensated or not. And that report took 2 years to complete, during which further tests on the DNA were done overseas. And Stuart came back in 2001 and said that, yes, he had proven his innocence on the balance of probabilities.
Okay.
And then he estimated how much compensation should be awarded.
Well, how do you do that, by the way?
Well, he took into account a kind of, I think he could had a daily rate of what this was, how much suffering this was, how much he also took a bit off because David had spent time in jail for a short time in jail for other offending, his loss of earnings. I mean, it was a whole complicated formula that he used and came to $868,000.
Are the public starting to get interested in this, by the way, at that
point?
Well,
they were. Yeah. Suddenly they were, because suddenly this was breaking new ground. And then, of course, and I can't remember the year that the person was arrested, Nicholas Reiki was arrested.
2003.
2003, right. So that was, yeah, that was about a year after David was compensated. So that was a whole other ball game because Nicholas Reiki had been on something of a raping spree despite the new profile having gone to the ESR So there was a story that I did subsequently about how it was sitting there before, I think, two or three of his rapes. So, you know, he could have been stopped earlier.
If they'd checked the sample from the earlier
of the retested DNA
against a known serial rapist.
Well, he wasn't a known serial rapist at that point, but his they would have had DNA from the first crime scene.
His first one, yeah.
His first one. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if it's because it was retested. You know, it wasn't in the data bank, it might not have been in the data bank in the usual places. I don't know, but it was missed.
Mm-hmm. So, and I imagine for you personally, when this guy's caught, it must just be an extra sort of, I suppose, vindicating moment?
Yeah, it was. And I think that... I think it was the first time that somebody else had been in wrongful conviction cases in New Zealand. I think it was the first time that the right guy had been got by the efforts of the people who got the first guy exonerated.
Because Arthur Allen Thomas,
there was nobody else convicted for the crew murders.
No.
So consequently, everybody still thinks it was him. I mean, now, of course, we've got Tina Pora and Malcolm Rewa.
Yeah. By the way, there was a movie about this case.
There was.
Was it Cohen Holloway? Did Cohen Holloway play David?
Cohen played David, yeah. He was fantastic. He won the gong for that performance, which was amazing.
It was called Until Proven Innocent. Did he get to see the movie?
David? Oh, yeah. Yes, he did. Yeah. We went to the preview. It was a cast and crew, I think, preview in Wellington, and David sent a message just telling Donna Mullane and Paula Bock and Cohen and the rest of the cast just how much it meant to him. So that was nice.
What was life like for David then after all that?
Probably went from bad to worse after that. I mean, he had alcohol issues which were exacerbated by his time in jail. I mean, he was broken. He was a broken man, and you could not put him together. And he struggled with alcohol, and he died of, I think it was effectively pancreatic cancer, or, you know, his pancreas was shot. But, I mean, I suppose at least he died with his name cleared, and that was hugely important to him. But he just drank himself to death.
And that's a story that we've heard in this slot before as well. And the Hollywood sort of story is innocent man gets released, hugs his wife, everything's great. Mm. But in fact, going through that is something that will change your life forever. In fact, I think his partner said that he was changed forever.
He was. And also, you know, we stress to David that $870,000 isn't actually a lot of money. And for somebody like David, he never believed us about that. And we said, you know, we wanted to put it in a trust, but he gave it away, basically. He bought a home for himself and Joanne in Ashurst. They moved there. And then he gave it away to his family. Mm. And he was a generous guy, and he was left with nothing. And the last time I ever heard from him, he rang, because I was still supporting him, and he rang, I think it was about 2010, was the last time I ever heard, and he said, could you pay for the bond on a flat? Because I think he'd had a brief separation from Joanne at that point. And he said, could you pay for the bond on my flat? And I remember his words, he said, I'll never darken your door again. And I said, David, don't feel like that. But he just felt so guilty about always asking for help. Mm. And I never heard from him again.
Is it one of the cases, one of the stories of your career, this one?
Oh, absolutely. You're never going to get too many people out of jail. But, yeah, and I had a lot of time for him.
And tell me about his death, or following his death.
Well, I didn't know about it until somebody rang me and asked if I'd heard about it, and I hadn't. I went round and visited his family as soon as I could, and there was the picture that we... Gosh, it still chokes me up. There was a picture that we had used when David came out of jail of him turning up his face to the rain, and they had that with his ashes, and it was pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah. Has anything changed that will stop this happening again?
I think there is a greater emphasis on independence in the ESR and a greater realisation that scientists could, at that time, get too close to the police and regard themselves as another arm of the prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's improved. There's still risks with forensic evidence. There's still risks with eyewitness identification. All those things are common in miscarriage of justice. You know, shonky forensic science, witness identification. All those things still exist. And who's to say another David couldn't happen again, but let's hope not.
You've been listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. You can find more episodes of the series on the RNZ podcast page or on Apple, on Spotify, or wherever you catch your favourite podcasts. And if you like this series, you might also like the award-winning RNZ podcast series, Gone Fishing. You can find it on the RNZ podcast page, along with lots of other great podcasts.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.